Picture a wall of white. Not the kind of white you see at a general aviation airport in February. This is the white of a place that has never been touched by anything ordinary. 20,000 feet of granite and ice above you, the air so thin it barely supports a propeller, and the sound of a small airplane engine echoing off walls of rock that close in on either side, like something from a bad dream. That is the Ruth Gorge. That is the Alaska Range. And threading through that gorge in a Cessna 180 with Tundra tires and a prayer was a man named Don Sheldon. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one is worth your time. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Don Sheldon was born in Wyoming in 1921. His family lost their ranch during the Depression. He drifted. He worked. He found his way to Alaska in the early 1940s, the way a lot of young men found their way to wild places back then, by following the work and the restlessness that comes when a man hasn't yet found the thing he was built to do. He found it in Talkeetna, Alaska. For those who haven't been there, sits at the junction of three rivers about 100 miles north of Anchorage, right at the edge of where the world decides to get serious. The Alaska Range rises out of the flat to the north, and Denali, the Great One, anchors it all at 20,310 feet above sea level. It is the highest peak in North America. It is also one of the most technically demanding and meteorologically violent mountains on the planet. The weather it generates is its own weather system. The mountain makes its own decisions. In the 1940s, climbers who wanted to attempt Denali had one option. They walked in, long, brutal approaches across the tundra, carrying enormous loads, weeks of travel before they ever touched the mountain itself. The logistics alone defeated most expeditions before they ever got to the climbing. Don Sheldon looked at that and thought there had to be a better way. He had learned to fly during the war. He came back to Talkeetna and started flying for anyone who needed it. Trappers, prospectors, hunters, the occasional researcher who wanted to go somewhere that roads don't reach. And in that part of Alaska, roads don't reach most places. Alaska bush flying in those years was not a profession for the faint of heart. The weather could kill you in an hour. The mountains had already killed better pilots than you. Navigation was dead reckoning, local knowledge and the ability to read terrain the way other people read a road map. You had to know the passes, which ones clouded first and which ones stayed open longest, which drainages funneled wind in a way that could flip a light airplane like a piece of paper, where you could put the airplane down in an emergency and where you absolutely could not. None of that was in any chart or any book. It lived in the memory of pilots who had flown it long enough to survive their mistakes. Sheldon was exceptional at all of it. Now here's where it gets interesting. In 1951, a mountaineer named Bradford Washburn approached Sheldon about making a landing on a glacier on the flanks of Denali. Washburn was a legendary figure in his own right. He was a cartographer, a photographer, a mountaineer who had already made the first ascents of several Alaskan peaks and who would eventually produce the most accurate map of Denali that had ever been made. He had a theory that if a pilot could put a plane down on the Kahiltna Glacier, climbers could be deposited near the mountain's base and bypass the entire approach march. Other pilots had looked at the glaciers and shaken their heads. The surface was unpredictable. Crevasses could swallow a landing gear whole, and you wouldn't see them coming until you were already in one. The altitude at base camp was roughly 7,000 feet, which meant your engine was breathing thin air, and your landing speeds were higher than the book said they should be. The terrain around those glaciers allowed for no margin. There was no going around in an emergency, no flat field to belly into. You either flew the airplane or the mountain flew you. Sheldon said he'd give it a try. What followed was not one dramatic landing, but a process, methodical, careful. Sheldon flew low and slow over the snowfields in the weeks and months before committing to a landing, studying the light and shadow, learning to read the subtle clues in surface texture that told him where the snow was firm and where it hid a crevasse that would eat his airplane for breakfast. He flew with a low sun angle deliberately, raking the surface with long shadows that revealed depressions and pressure ridges that high noon light would wash completely flat. He learned the glacier the way you learn a mountain runway, from the air, from many angles over many visits, until the picture in your head is more reliable than anything written down. He landed first on skis. Later, he developed techniques for wheel ski combinations that let him operate from prepared surfaces and from the unpacked snow of the high glaciers. He refined his approach procedures for high altitude operations where the energy margins were different from anything in the lower 48. He kept notes. He kept flying. The Kahiltna Glacier, he determined, was manageable if you knew exactly where to put the airplane and how to manage your descent rate on approach. The Ruth Glacier was trickier, narrower. The walls of the Ruth Gorge on either side of that glacier are extraordinary, even by Alaska range standards. They rise thousands of feet of sheer granite directly from the ice. There is no room for a wide pattern, no room for indecision. You fly a precise line down the gorge, you commit to the glacier, and you put it down where you plan to put it, or you have a very serious problem. Sheldon learned the Ruth too.
And once he started landing on Denali's glaciers, everything changed. Climbers could now be deposited within striking distance of their routes, with supplies, with fresh food, sometimes within days of their summit bids rather than weeks. What had required a brutal month-long approach could now be accomplished in an hour of flying from Talkeetna. Sheldon became the logistics backbone of Alaskan mountaineering. Japanese expeditions, American expeditions, European expeditions, European expeditions. Teams from around the world who wanted Denali reached out to the man in the small town at the edge of the Alaska Range because without him, the mountain was much harder to get to. He was extraordinary at it. But glacier flying is also rescue flying, and that is where Sheldon's legend really grew. The number of climbers he pulled off that mountain is difficult to count precisely, but the stories are remarkable. Injured climbers on steep slopes where a normal approach was impossible. Parties pinned down by weather with food running out. Frostbite cases that needed to get to a hospital before the next storm moved in and closed the window entirely. There is a story told about a rescue on the Ruth that captures Sheldon better than any statistics can. A climber had broken his leg at a section of the glacier where the available landing area was, to put it charitably, marginal. The slope was wrong for a safe rollout. Crevasses were close on both sides. The approach required threading through terrain that left essentially no room for error on either side. Sheldon flew up and looked at it. He circled, he looked again, he landed anyway. He got the man out. He got himself out. When people asked him later how he had made that calculation, how he had decided what was possible and what wasn't, he would deflect. He'd talk about the conditions that day, about the airplane, about luck. He didn't have the language for what he actually did, which was a kind of accumulated wisdom that lives in the hands and gut of a pilot who has flown the same terrain for decades. The airport is in your head at that point. Every ridge, every shadow, every trick of mountain light at every time of day and every season. You know things you cannot teach, things that don't fit in a ground school handbook and never will. He built a small stone cabin on the Ruth Glacier, on a flat section he found at roughly 6,000 feet, surrounded on all sides by some of the most dramatic mountain scenery on the North American continent. That place is called the Don Sheldon Amphitheater now, and climbers and visitors still get flown there by the pilots who followed in his tracks. It is one of the stranger and more beautiful places I can think of, a tiny stone hut in the middle of a landscape that belongs to a different planet. A monument to the idea that a determined person with an airplane can find a way into places the world has decided are unreachable. Sheldon didn't just fly climbers, he flew everyone. The biology researchers counting wolves from the air, the photographers chasing the alpenglow on the range at golden hour, the trappers who needed to be at their line before freeze-up closed the rivers. The hunting parties whose fees were part of what kept small-town Alaska economics running through the winter. He knew the terrain from the Susitna Valley to the heart of the Alaska Range, the way a suburban commuter knows every turn of his highway home. He knew it because he had flown it thousands of times, in a Cessna 180 and a Super Cub, and whatever else the job required, accumulating something that goes beyond hours and starts to become a different kind of knowledge entirely. Alaska bush flying in that era had a particular culture. You were the infrastructure. There were no roads. There were no alternatives. When someone needed out or needed something brought in, the airplane was not a convenience, it was a lifeline, the difference between life and death, sometimes, and that changes the way you think about flying. The weather forecast is not an abstraction, it is the thing standing between someone and the help they need. You take it seriously in a way that is hard to explain to someone who has never been the only pilot within 100 miles in any direction. The only airplane between a person and the help they need. Sheldon took it as seriously as any pilot who ever strapped in.
He was also, by all accounts, not an easy man to know. He was stubborn, opinionated about his airplanes and his mountains in the way that people get when they have spent their life developing an understanding that most people will never have, and they know it. He had standards that had been tested against the Alaska Range and had come back standing, and he was not interested in shortcuts or theories from people who hadn't put their gear to what he'd put his to. But the people he flew trusted him completely. And in that country at that time, trust was the highest compliment a pilot could receive. Don Sheldon died in 1975. He had been fighting cancer, but he kept flying as long as the doctors and his body allowed, because the mountains were where he belonged, and flying was what he did. He was 53 years old. By then he had logged more than 12,000 hours in Alaska, most of them in terrain that would give most pilots a cold sweat just looking at it on a chart. The pilots who fly out of Talkeetna today, the ones who carry mountaineers up to the Kahiltna for their Denali expeditions every spring, they are flying the routes Sheldon pioneered. They are using techniques he developed on a mountain he learned from the air. His name is on the amphitheater. His fingerprints are on the whole operation. That is not a bad legacy for a Wyoming ranch kid who drifted north and finally found the thing he was built to do. His story is told in a book called Wager with the Wind, written by James Greiner, and the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum in Anchorage carries the broader history of what pilots like Sheldon built in that state. Both are worth your time. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'll see you next time.